This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, this is Claire McDonnell and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. Hello and welcome to Weekend Woman's Hour with me, Claire McDonnell. There is a sprinkling of stardust today as Rachel Stevens, one of the founding members of S Club 7, is here to talk about her life, her time in the band and what it was like being in the public eye. The author, Laura Dockrell, tells us about her latest book, some of it based on her own story of first love and falling for her best friend.
I just thought love really wasn't for me. I was so, as a teenager, I was always friend zoning myself, could never find the boy zone. And then annoyed when I met this really lovely guy.
What age were you?
I was 14. We made mixtapes for each other, love letters, mixtapes and letters that I would spray with White Mask Body Shop in the hope that that would entrance him.
We'll be hearing about a new production of the play Wedding Band, a love-hate story in black and white that explores the impact of laws that stated interracial marriage was unnatural, known as the anti-miscegenation laws. Plus, the actor Jill Halfpenny on love, loss and facing her grief head-on in her new memoir. So, no disruptions for the next hour, just you, me, the radio and a cup of what you fancy. S Club 7 were a British pop band that took the world by storm in the early 2000s. Kids and adults alike learn the dances to their songs, join their club and even watch the band on their own TV show. One of those members is Rachel Stevens. She went on to have her own successful solo career and has graced our TV screens in shows such as Strictly Come Dancing and more recently Dancing with the Stars. Now she has a book out, Finding My Voice, a story of strength, belief and S Club. It's Rachel's debut memoir about her life, her time in the hit-making band, her solo career and what it's been like being in the public eye. Rachel joined Anita earlier this week and she began by asking her, why publish a memoir now?
Why now? I mean, the opportunity came up and yeah, I had to really think long and hard about doing it because if I'm going to write it, I was like, I have to be really honest, really open and tell my truth. And that's something that honestly I've through my career, through life, found really difficult to just let my... I've always had this sort of protection up and I was scared of that because I wanted to really, you know, be honest.
Well, writing this book then is facing a fear.
It is.
Opening up.
I mean, honestly, sometimes, well, a lot before, especially interviews, I would feel my heart would race and I would think to myself, I'm just having a conversation. I'm just talking. But for me, going through my career, interviews have felt like a very exposing thing for me. So I always found it really, really hard because I would self-censor. I would feel like my words would get stuck in my throat. Trying to articulate everything I felt, you know, I'm someone who sort of would think a lot, I'm a very deep thinker and would feel a lot and couldn't access the thoughts with the feelings and just be myself and just be in the moment. So it's been a real sort of process to unravel everything and put the pieces back together.
So when you look back at you starting out in the S Club, young you, because you're only a teenager, and having to do those interviews, like what was going on? Why were you self-censored?
I grew up in a home where I felt like I was a lot of emphasis was put on looks and how we looked and the outside and
You say that you're all
seen and not heard, that kind of...
You had to be well turned out.
Well turned out. And I felt like I just had to be a certain way. And I just felt like I wasn't seen and wasn't heard growing up. And that sort of carried through my life. And interestingly, really carried through into S Club because that was very much about how I looked. And it became a real emphasis on that. And everything was just inside. And I kept just kind of pushing it all down. And it's all there, isn't it? It doesn't go anywhere, but it manifests in other ways. So it would manifest in anxiety, worry, real low self-esteem. I mean, gosh, it could go on and on. But yeah, it was a lot to unravel.
Yeah. And also, I guess your position in the band. I mean, you're so ridiculously beautiful. And I suppose everyone was, especially in the 90s, especially a woman in the pop industry at the 90s, they see you as a certain way. And maybe you were the gorgeous one. And maybe you weren't expected to say anything.
Well, yeah, it was a concoction of so many different things. I mean, being in a pop group of that at that time, everyone saw the sort of final polished, glossy finish. And everything that I came into the band at a very sort of shaky time in my life. I was, my family had just sort of fallen apart. My parents had separated. We'd lost our home. I was very like, I didn't have that strong sense of self or a foundation of family, which was everything to me growing up. So I kind of went into the band and was like, I was always very driven, very career driven. And I just threw myself into it 100%, but became this version of what I thought others expected me to be. And yeah, you know, like you said, being a teenager, you're still finding yourself. And I found it very hard to sort of, got very lost in it. Yeah.
But it came to you as a real gift. I mean, you were working in the canteen at Sony and yeah. In the background somewhere, hundreds, thousands of young people were auditioning to be in this yeah. new supergroup that they were putting
Crazy.
Together.
A real sliding doors moment.
Sliding doors moment in your life.
Absolutely.
Because two record execs just saw you mm-hmm. and said, fancy being a pop star. I mean, obviously I'm paraphrasing. You tell the story.
Yeah, well, no, exactly. I mean, it really was such an... from then on, it was a real whirlwind. I mean, they approached me to... They said, literally said, can you sing? I mean, it was a pipe dream, obviously. You know, I remember, like, I was so passionate about music, always singing. But I'd never been that kid who'd auditioned for things. If I was going to be in a school play, I'd be the tree. You know what I mean? I wasn't like...
What were you singing in your bedroom? Or who were you singing?
Oh, God. I was a... Oh, God. I grew up with a lot of, like, the greats. Obviously, Michael Jackson, Prince, Madonna, Elvis. Elvis, my brother was a big Elvis fan, so he was always playing. My dad loved soul music. So a lot of, like, Teddy Pendergrass and... Dusty Springfield. Oh my God, I could go on and on and on. And then I loved my pop as well. But Rick Astley, Kylie Minogue, Rick Astley, it's crazy how I thought of him first.
Well, he's like, got an amazing voice. That's why I'm great pop songs.
He just came to me
yeah,
straight
brilliant.
Away. Kylie, Jason, that whole thing, and Madonna, you know. So I just loved music. But I never thought, I had never been to drama school or auditioned or thought I could sing. I didn't, you know, but I was like very career driven and I was always like, if an opportunity presents, I'm going to go for it. So I was a real contradiction in a way. So yeah, I just was like, yeah. And I just kind of went along. And it was for a solo artist that they were putting together, this real manufactured pop artist called Lolly. And I fit the bill. I looked like, you know, who they thought she would look like. And I went into the studio, started recording. And unbeknownst to me, S Club was being put together and auditions were happening and it all went from there.
And so with that, do you feel that, I mean, I think this comes out in your memoir a bit of imposter syndrome.
Oh my gosh, yeah, absolutely, massively. And of course, I didn't really know what that was then. I mean, we talk about
it a lot now. We talk about it now, yeah.
You know, we all say it, mental health wasn't a thing then. No one talked really or talked about it. So everything was just going on inside. But what I feel very grateful for is I've always been passionate ever since I was young about mental health and growth and self-development. I've always been so curious about why I struggled so much with anxiety as I got a little bit older, why I felt it so hard to just be vulnerable and allow myself to be myself. I didn't know who myself was at that point, but yeah, just to questioning, really questioning.
And how did you navigate it? How did you cope? I mean, it's the 90s. It's pop music mm-hmm. in the 2000s, I should say. It wasn't the 90s. It was yeah. 2000s. FHM, Loaded. Yeah. And you were on the cover. You were, you know, yeah. one of the key pinup girls of that time.
Yeah. I think I coped with just pushing it all away and putting the smile on and putting the show on and just sort of being who I thought people expected to me. But then behind the scenes, I was therapy. I've been in therapy since I was really young and I needed an outlet. I needed someone to... I was always searching, basically, for answers and understanding as why I found it so hard to connect and sort of be open and what was going on. There was a lot of confusion that I was carrying and I think a lot of shame and a lot of... So much was going on. So I was always searching. And so that was my coping mechanism, was to put that protection up. But it really started to do the opposite, obviously, and not serve me in any way because it would hold me back from so many things of being present, of... connect human connection and you make choices of more I don't know if this is the right thing to say, but more sort of surface choices in a way of your life when you're not fully connected to what you really need, want, deserve. You don't know how to set boundaries, all of those things. I mean, as I've gotten older, we're all learning on the go, aren't we? And we're just muddling through the best, you know, life is messy and it's a constant working on ourselves.
What was it like having the other band members around you?
We had so many incredible times. I mean, but we were all kids, really, and we were all finding our own way. We all had our own stuff going on, like we all do. And we worked so hard, which for me was, I mean, it taught me such a strong work ethic. And like I've said, I've always been so driven and career driven and always known that you've got to put the work in to get the results. So, and we did. I mean, we had an incredible time. We worked with some of the best in the business, and our music really does stand the test of time, you know.
So yeah, absolutely.
But we had fun. We did have fun.
And you're back, but obviously we must mention, because we know that in April 2023 you as a band learnt about the passing of Paul Cattermole. I mean, what was that time like for you all?
Oh, it was just heartbreaking. I mean, we'd all come back together. Everyone was really he was so excited about it. And it was really special getting to know him again as grown-ups, and sort of we had a couple of really lovely chats, and he was just such a beautiful soul. But yeah, it was really heartbreaking, and we took time to just, obviously the tour was in motion at that point, but we took time to just process and, but there was no talk of the tour not happening. It just kind of stopped, and then we were like, it took on a whole nother beautiful thing of a tribute to him and a celebration of everything. I mean, 25 years in itself is such an incredible thing.
It's huge.
And we really got to celebrate him, which felt like a really special thing to do.
And it's a very special thing to be able to do. Yeah. When you say 25 years though, Rachel, there will be people sitting up going, that has dated all of us. That S Club.
Let's just
has
pretend
reformed.
We were like 10 when we.
Is it one of those things? Do you feel, I mean, obviously you're an adult female now, but you know when you know someone from a certain period in your life and they will forever be that person?
Totally.
You'll forever be a teenager.
When I hear
that's
back,
no
back,
bad
I
thing.
I thought that when I was listening to that, I'm like, oh my God, it takes me back to being 19 again, for sure.
Rachel Stevens there, and her memoir, Finding My Voice, is out now. On Tuesday this week, Nuala presented an extended edition of Woman's Hour, our election debate. We heard from senior women representing the seven main political parties of Great Britain, who answered questions on issues that you have told us matter to you in this general election. The participants were not told the issues or questions in advance. The politicians taking part were, in the studio, Reform UK candidate Maria Botell, the Green Party of England and Wales's spokesperson for housing and communities, Ellie Chowns, Daisy Cooper, deputy leader of the Liberal Democrats. And on video link, we had the Conservative Party's Mims Davies, Minister of State for Disabled People, Health and Work, Hannah Bardell, spokesperson for Consular Affairs and International Engagement for the SNP, the Scottish National Party, Labour's Shadow Minister for Industry and Decarbonisation, Sarah Jones, and Plaid Cymru's Westminster leader, Liz Saville-Roberts. One of the topics you wanted us to discuss was how safe you feel, whether you're in your own home, on the street or online. Listener Kate asked, what will your party do to tackle the growing violence against women and girls, from prevention to culturally appropriate support for victims? First to answer the question on keeping you safe was Conservative Party's Mims Davies.
Well, first off, domestic violence is criminality in the home, and it absolutely should be treated as so. We have also obviously passed the Stalking Protection Act in 2019, to protect women with those stalking protection orders, and the landmark Domestic Abuse Act in 2020, which also importantly brought children in as victims as well. And we've made it very clear in our manifesto that protecting women and women and girls, women's safety, is at the heart of what we do. And just talking about the football, our local police and crime commissioner, Katie Bourne, and many others are doing work around this to make sure that this is not an extra time that women are vulnerable as well. And we've
but
also
the Conservatives have been. Forgive me, Mims. The Conservatives have been in power for 14 years. These issues, we've seen them so recently, as I mentioned, Sarah Everard and others. Why do you think that the Conservatives have not been able to get to a level of safety that women who are getting in touch with us feel is appropriate?
Yeah, as I say, we brought in the offence of stalking in 2012, the Modern Slavery Act in 2015, again focused around human trafficking and protection for the victims and for women. And absolutely, I think we have had a focus on this, and it continually needs to have a focus, whatever government is in place, in my view, hence the work that we've done around the Domestic Abuse Act. And I think it's something that's brought us across the house together in terms of listening and learning and working together. And I think trust in police in particular is very important in terms of helping us to all feel safe.
But, you know, I did a call in not that long ago on Women's Hour, and there were many stories of people not feeling safe when it came to the police. Let me hold it there, because I do want to get answers as well from our other participants.
Quickly, the Safer Streets Fund has gone out to local authorities, police and crime commissioners.
Mim Davies, we have to leave it there. Let me turn to Daisy Cooper. Sorry, please don't speak over me. Daisy Cooper from the Liberal Democrats.
Thank you. Well, I mean, in the last Parliament, one of our MPs actually pushed through the Worker Protect Action Act, which would give a legal duty on employers to protect their employees from sexual harassment. We brought the upskirting offence into law. And we also led for the ban on revenge porn. So we've got a good, strong track record in this area. In terms of things that we would like to see, the first is that we'd like to make misogyny a hate crime.
But, you know, the Law Commission review did say that that risked creating hierarchies of victim, and it may prove more harmful than helpful.
What, making misogyny a hate crime?
Correct.
Absolutely. There are lots of other hate crimes that already exist. And what you would do is you're not creating a new offence. You're actually saying that an existing offence would become an aggravating offence, and it'd be taken into account, excuse me, in sentencing. So there is broad support for making misogyny a hate crime, and Liberal Democrats are committed to doing that. But there are many other things that we can do. So in the police...
Let me keep that with you, because I'm going to have to go around everybody quite quickly, and I want to make sure that everybody gets at least their take across. Sarah Jones for Labour, maybe you want to pick up on that, whether misogyny should be a hate crime.
Yes, it should. I mean, our country on the broader issue faces a tidal wave of violence against women and girls, and there is total impunity for the vast majority of those responsible. So we will set a target to halve violence against women and girls, which is incredibly ambitious, and will take a raft of measures to do. I mean, the first thing is to put specialists into our court systems on race and domestic abuse victims. The second is to have specialist domestic abuse workers in all our 999 call centres. We want to tackle misogyny, as I've said. We want to give domestic abusers no place to hide by introducing a new domestic abuse register. We want to tackle the causes by talking about misogyny in schools. We need to have a strategy on incels in terms of our online harms. We want minimum sentencings on race, rape. We've got a whole raft of measures, because this is a
Sarah Jones, you have from Labour, you've laid out some of the issues you are looking at or hoping to implement if Labour comes into power. Maria Botel for reform.
Yeah, so I think it comes back to policing as well, in terms of the people feeling safe and whether I feel safe or not.
And
almost. And
do you mean policing about the police being trusting the police, or do you mean more policing in areas?
Both. So we've said 40,000 extra police officers and also more stringent
funded
checks.
How?
So that's, we've laid out our manifesto or contract yesterday, and that states there's lots of different areas that we want to pull funding in from. Do you want me to go through them all? Do you want me to talk about the plans?
Give me one specific of how you'd fund it.
So stop paying interest to the banks.
Sorry?
So then the money that was printed, Richard Tice has said about not paying interest on it voluntarily, especially at the current interest rates.
And that, I want to continue going round the table, so that is your main
Well, for me,
issue.
No, I would say grooming gangs as well, and making sure that if they have dual citizenship and they commit a crime such as rape or the part of a grooming gang, they are deported, because that's not spoken about enough.
Thank you very much, Maria Botel. Let me turn to Ellie Chowns, the Green Party.
For the Greens, it's absolutely a priority to end domestic violence and violence against women and girls. We would make misogyny a hate crime across the UK. We want to develop and implement a UK-wide strategy to tackle domestic abuse and violence against women and girls. We want more investment in the police, we want to make sure that they recognise domestic abuse and gender-based violence as key indicators on which their performance is assessed, and that they're trained to recognise and tackle domestic abuse. And crucially, we want to fund local authorities so that they can support the rape crisis centres, the organisations that support women and girls facing domestic violence, because too often those organisations are facing a hand-to-mouth struggle for
funding.
And sorry,
did you say, would you make misogyny a hate crime?
Yes.
Very clear there. Let me turn to Liz Saville Roberts for Plaid Cymru.
I would
How
like
are you
to pay
keeping? What would
to,
your party do to keep women safe?
Yeah, I would like to pay respect to Rhiannon Bragg, who I believe has appeared on this programme. Rhiannon Bragg of Roscadfan, talking as the victim of stalking, a serious stalking offence, and she makes how evident we need to increase the sentencing for stalking. We need to improve training for police. We need to actually look at the licence orders of when stalkers are released, and we need to look at restraining orders as well, because the reality of what victims experience, even though these actions will go through courts, but the offenders will be released, and the control over them, looking at the way that probation has had cuts made to it, looking at actually the way that victims experience justice in the England and Wales legal system as things stand, has to be changed for women to feel safe. In a wider view, I have worked on domestic abuse since I became a member of Parliament. I pushed for a domestic abuse register when both Labour and Tories pushed back against it. It is now being talked about as being brought in with the most recent legislation.
You want a separate victims commissioner for Wales?
We very much want a separate victims commissioner for Wales, because what we see with the jagged edge of how people experience
many of the
services...
Liz Saville-Roberts, forgive me, let me leave it there, because I want to make sure to get in Hannah Bardell from the SNP before we go to the news.
On the question of making misogyny a hate crime, we obviously commissioned Tillina Kennedy, the Labour peer, who did fantastic work. Yes, I think we should do that. We have an equally safe strategy in Scotland, which has done a lot to tackle domestic abuse and world-leading domestic abuse legislation. But also, it's important to remember that our MP, Ailie Whiteford, who's no longer in Parliament, she had a private member's bill to ratify the Istanbul Convention. We have to work more with police. I mean, Police Scotland did a brilliant campaign on Don't Be That Guy. We also have to engage men in the conversation as well. They're a huge part of this, but protecting women and girls in online spaces as well, and having a really serious conversation about the culture in Parliament too, because you've got to remember we have had some abhorrent behaviour in Parliament and some terrible cases.
Is that in your manifesto? Well, I'll repeat that it was released about half an hour ago.
So I don't want to jump the gun on that, but yes, in terms of much of this being devolved, and also we want to get rid of corroboration, and that's something that's been looked at by our Lord Advocate Dorothy Bain, which has been a major barrier in terms of rape cases. But we have to recognise that in Scotland, England, Wales, across the UK, that the rate of conviction of rape cases and even them coming to court is woefully low, and we all need to do more.
And I just want to turn to Sarah Jones in Labour in for 30 seconds, Sarah, if you don't mind. When it comes to prevention, there's talk about going into schools, for example, teaching children. But what about men that are already grown that are to stop them carrying out these acts in the first place? It's all very well to talk about victims, but before a woman becomes a victim. 30 seconds.
Yeah, no, I think the way that we talk about these issues in schools is incredibly important, to teach men what it is to be a man, what's appropriate, what's consent is, and how that works. And there are some good practice in terms of schools and how they
but
are
not
doing.
Schools, I'm talking about when they're fully grown men.
There are also projects. I can remember when I was Shadow Policing Minister that in South Wales they were doing some really good work working with perpetrators. And in London, what they've done is they are identifying who the kind of most at-risk
okay, so,
men are.
Okay, so profiling in one way. Sarah Jones, thank you very much.
Nuala was talking to Hannah Bardell from the Scottish National Party, Reform UK's Maria Botell, the Green Party's Ellie Chowns, Daisy Cooper from the Liberal Democrats, the Conservative Party's Mims Davies, Labour's Sarah Jones and Plaid Cymru's Liz Saville-Roberts. You can hear the whole 90-minute debate by going to BBC Sounds for Tuesday the 18th of June. There will be more election coverage right here on Woman's Hour as our series of leader interviews continue as we head towards polling day. And do visit the BBC News election webpages for every possible twist, turn and detail on the general election campaign, including a full list of candidates standing in all constituencies. Actor Jill Halfpenny is best known for her roles on TV in iconic series such as Biker Grove, Coronation Street, EastEnders, and most recently, The Cuckoo. And on stage, where she won an Olivier Award for her role in the musical Legally Blonde. She's also won the second series of Strictly Come Dancing. But when Jill was just 4 years old, her dad died suddenly of a heart attack. Then, in 2017, in similarly tragic circumstances, her partner Matt died. These two tragic events have framed Jill's life story, and in her new book, A Life Reimagined, My Journey of Hope in the Midst of Loss, she explains how, as an adult, she decided to confront her grief head-on, which she'd been unable to do as a child. Jill joined me this week, and I began by asking her what she remembered about the day her dad died.
I don't actually remember a lot about that day. I was told about it by my sisters and my mum. But basically, my dad went out to play a game of football, a friendly match, and he had a heart attack on the pitch and he died. So as far as I was aware, my dad left the house and never came back. And, you know, it was 1979. We're in the northeast of England. We're not in therapy. We're not talking about our feelings. And I just went to school in the September, and I guess my mum, bless her, went into survival mode, and we just got on. And then what happened, I think, is really grief became my driver in many ways. You know, the sort of suppressed, unprocessed feelings became a driver for me to do things to get out of my own head. So in some ways it drove my ambition for a long time, because I just wanted to run away from any uncomfortable feelings I had.
And it made you very successful.
Yeah. I think, you know, trauma as a driver works for a certain amount of time, and then unfortunately it catches up with you and it says, hey, like, you're running on the wrong engine here. Like, you really need to work out what is good for you and what isn't. And you need to really start processing things, because that's not going, because the frightening aspect is, if I process this pain, if I really turn towards my feelings, will I lose part of myself? And no, you won't. For anybody listening, you absolutely don't. What you do is you can just live alongside your pain and your grief in a way that's far more comfortable. That's what I've found anyway.
To go back to your mother for a second, as you say, it was the 1970s. Mm. People weren't talking about mental health openly, processing their feelings. Children were certainly not front and centre. They had to sort of look to the adults and take their lead. What do you think about what your mum was going through now, looking back, and how she handled it?
I think she must have been terrified, absolutely terrified. And she must have just thought, I have to get out of bed every day. I have to give my children breakfast and I have to send them to school. And somehow I have to do that every single day from now until they're adults. And I think what happens is, as a child, you don't have the vocabulary and you don't have the words to be able to say, are you all right? Because you don't look all right. You know, I feel a bit anxious inside, you know, we don't have this kind of words. So I think what happens is, you know, I grew up with a mum who was obviously in a huge amount of pain and was really scared and was grieving. But she, because she wasn't telling me that was how she was feeling, what happened was I became quite an anxious child, because what I was seeing and what I was feeling were in contradiction with each other. So,
yeah. And there was one moment in the book which is very cuts through, really, that only once did she, you recall her letting her emotions out, when you heard her in this guttural cry and you just didn't know what it was. You ran in to see what was going on.
Yeah, I was playing out in the street and I ran into the house and I heard what I thought was my mum laughing really, really hard. I thought, how strange, like, what was she? It sounded like quite scary though, the laugh. And I came in and I peeked round the corner and she wasn't laughing. She was crying, but she was wailing crying. And she was hugging my then uncle. And he just looked at me and he sort of just shooed me away with his hand. And I guess, you know, from maybe that moment on, I realised that maybe I wasn't welcome in my mum's grief. And it's such a small moment, but we take those cues so vividly when we're kids, and we put them in a box somewhere inside of us and, you know, never to be spoken of again.
And you say your then uncle, yes. Your mum went on To marry?
To marry my dad's brother, yes.
And how was that?
Well, at the time, again, I was very young, so as far as I could see, it was, oh, how lovely this man has stepped in to look after our family. And it was lovely, and he is lovely, and I've nothing but love for him. But obviously, there were people who maybe thought differently and had some judgment upon that. And again, it wasn't talked about, so there was just a lot of undercurrent in my family of things that we didn't talk about, and we just got on and... I think it's just important for me to say as well that I think, you know, my childhood, you know, I had lots of happy times, and I think those can live alongside the anxious times and the sad times as well.
I mean, you say when you kind of suppressed all these feelings and it came out, your medication was alcohol, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
When you left home. Tell us a little bit about that.
So I think I always had this feeling that I didn't belong. I always had this weird, like, everybody else seemed to know the secret to life. Everybody else, like, knew how to live, and I didn't. And I never said that to anyone because I thought, well, people will think I've gone mad. And alcohol just quiet, just made the voices inside my head just a bit quieter. So I would dampen those voices down with alcohol. And after a while, you know, it was in my sort of late 30s, I realised that I felt like I used alcohol in a way that maybe other people didn't. And I wasn't, you know, I want to make this really clear because I think addiction is fairly misunderstood. I had not got to the point in my life where I was destroying things, or I wasn't able to hold down jobs, or I wasn't able to hold down relationships. I was what you would call a very, very high functioning alcoholic. But what I saw was a future for myself that I didn't want. I saw a future for myself, this relationship that I had with alcohol. I thought, I don't think it's going to get better. I think it's going to get worse. So when I went into recovery, it was me trying to say, no, this, I want more for myself, and what can I do to change? And the only thing I had to do was just stop drinking the alcohol. And suddenly, once I stopped doing that, I was able to face and talk about so many different... It gave me the space to confront all of the things that I hadn't been confronting.
And that was very, very useful, because I'm sorry to have to ask you about this next chapter in your life, but your partner, Matt, died in a very similar way to your dad. If it's not too difficult, can you talk to us about what happened to Matt?
Yeah, Matt was also very keen on exercise, and he went to a spin class one morning, and he died in the class. So it was very, very shocking, and it was very unexpected. And once that had happened, I just knew very, very deep down inside of me, I just knew that I was going to have to go on this journey, and I was going to have to walk straight through it. There was going to be no avoidance. There was going to be no over or under or around. I was going to have to walk through it. And I knew ultimately as well that all the feelings of grief that had been unprocessed from my dad, they were going to have to be dealt with as well in sobriety.
That is so tough. So, so tough. And you, I mean, you detail it in the book. You know, you don't shy away from all the issues that brought up in your life. By this point, you had a young son, Harvey. Yes. How did that help? Because obviously you have a chance to kind of almost do your life over. So in your childhood, the adults around you said, we're not talking about that. You didn't take that path with your own son, did you?
Yeah, I just remember thinking, okay, I've got to be as honest as I can with my son. And basically the approach I took was that I was going to be honest about how I felt, but I was always going to follow that up with, but I will be okay and I will get through it because we can, like, as human beings, we're amazing, we're brilliant. So I would often, you know, he'd come home from school and he was a very eloquent, sort of emotionally eloquent little boy anyway, but he'd say, how are you? How was your day? And often I'd say, honestly, Harvey, it was pretty awful today. I've spent most of it crying. I'm really glad to see you, though. I'm glad you're home. Do you mind tonight if we just watch our favourite programme and cuddle on the sofa, because that's about all I've got in me today? And he'd be like, yeah, that's okay. And I would just try and do it in that way, because I just thought, I do not want my son to look into my eyes and see this crumpled, pained face and for me to go, everything's fine, it's okay, let's go to the park, it'll all be okay. I thought, no, I can't bear the idea that he's going to grow up and think, why is Mum lying to me, you know?
Jill Halfpenny and Jill's memoir, A Life Reimagined, is out now. For more than a century, many Americans believed that interracial marriage was unnatural. From the late 1860s through to the late 1960s, the American legal system supported the belief that they were illegitimate and deemed them illegal. Wedding Band, a love-hate story in black and white, is a play by Alice Childress that explores the impact of these laws known as anti-miscegenation laws. Set in the deep south of the USA in 1918, Julia, a black seamstress, and Herman, a white baker, are defying the odds and objections with their secret love. The play is currently on stage at the Lyric Theatre in Hammersmith in London. Earlier this week, Anita was joined in the studio by Monique Tuco, who has directed the play, and also by Dr. Lenny Sorensen, who specialises in African American history and culture, who joined us from Charlottesville, Virginia, where it was only 5 a.m. And Anita began by asking Monique why the play, although written in 1962 during the heat of the civil rights era, wasn't shown on Broadway until 10 years later.
Alice wrote the play, and in terms of her activism and in terms of the woman that she is, was quite unapologetic with the depiction that she wrote. And there were quite a lot of pushback, actually, from producers and for people within the industries, just saying how hard-hitting it was and how the themes were really resonant, but also just quite radical for the time. So it took a while for the play to come on and be put on Broadway.
So who are Julia and Herman, the central characters? Tell us about them.
So Julia and Herman have been in a relationship for 10 years. It has been a relationship that has, it's been hard for them because both sides of the families have not been supportive of the relationship due to the time and the context. Because of their relationship, our central female character, Julia, has been moving and moving and moving because of the risk of the relationship. She's a seamstress, he's a baker. He actually comes from a family where the father had some attachment to the Ku Klux Klan. So he's come from quite a racist context. So the fact that they're together is a big deal, But love conquers all, as they say.
By the second half of the play, the pressures from the outside of their relationship have set them up against each other. How do the people around the two of them respond to the relationship?
So initially, Julia moves into this community in South Carolina. She's only been there a day or so, and they find out about this relationship. And initially, the women are quite, they're quite honest about how they are against black people and white people being together. So she's met with, I suppose, confrontation and also just judgment, which she's been experiencing for many years. And then on Herman's side of the family, it's the same, if not worse, because it's his actual family. So people are not wanting them to be together. And also the context doesn't allow them to be together either.
I'm going to bring Lenny in on this to give us the context. But before you do, Lenny, you are our expert and you're here as a historian, but it actually is your own experience as well, because your parents were an interracial couple. If you don't mind me mentioning, you were born in the 1940s in California. So what was the reaction to your mixed family like growing up?
Well, my mother's family, white family, she was kind of the odd daughter out in any case. So probably they were shocked. She always felt that they had rejected her, and it probably was the case. My dad's family were very accepting, and I knew them well and interacted with them whenever it was, you know, we visited. California, as you know, is a pretty big place, so we visited sometimes frequently and sometimes not so frequently. But I knew my grandparents and my cousins. And
but your parents couldn't get married legally in California, so they had to marry in Mexico. Know,
yeah, and they just handled it. They just did what they did. They were kids, you know, they were young and impressionable, and they decided, well, they were going to get married, and they did. He went off to the war, so I was born in 42, and he ended up in Europe, and as many marriages in that particular time didn't last, theirs did not last, but it wasn't necessarily because of racial issues. It was just because of distance and time, and they didn't know each other that well. California was odd in that people who might have reactions kind of kept them to themselves, well, I have a feeling.
Is that because it's a more of a liberal state?
I have a feeling, yes, especially after 1948 when the law changed. A black soldier brought home a German war bride, and in order to have his marriage recognized legally, the case was taken to the California Supreme Court, and in that setting, the anti-mixed race laws were struck. And as someone had said earlier, being one of your posts, it wasn't just a question of blacks and whites marrying; it was a question of Mexicans and whites or Chinese, a lot of different people were considered mixed.
Yeah. So when did these laws come into play? These this miscegenation law. When were they introduced?
Well, before 1860, when that word miscegenation was coined.
Tell us what the word means. I think people might have forgotten.
Well, it's a very specific term that means anti-race mixing, but it's actually a made-up word by a couple of newspaper editors who were trying to write scurrilous material about Abraham Lincoln during his second run for office. So it's a really odd term, but it was something about it caught the racists' notion of having this very specific term. Before that, and I will just be very quick, it was the interracial relationships were called amalgamation. It still was not acceptable, and in many cases, of course, was illegal. So, like, suddenly things became illegal. It had always been illegal for people to formally marry, mm-hmm. but the term was amalgamation and was more concerned about fears of white women being attracted to black men or black men being, whatever. Those were the fears that went along with that.
Monique, this play is having its first outing in London. Mm. Why did you want to direct it? What attracted you to this story?
Rachel O'Riordan, the artistic director, called me and said, I've got this play, I've been sitting on this play. It's an African-American classic. And if I'm being honest, when I initially read it, I was scared. It was a challenge.
What scared you?
The text scared me, the idea of doing something that is, part of the canon, part of history, the idea of depicting quite a specific community, and just the language. The language is raw and it's true, and she's not hiding. So for me, it was quite confronting, the material. And I saw myself in Julia. I saw myself in that central character. It was a challenge.
In what sense?
To do it.
Go on.
I'd been in an interracial relationship before, so I understood that dynamic. I understood the strength of that love and what it means, and just the responsibility of doing a UK premiere of such massive work. This woman doesn't get enough flowers, I think. She's done incredible work over the years. So, yeah, that was the reason why.
And there's a centering around the women on stage as well.
100%.
The opening scene.
Yes.
A stage full of black women.
Completely.
And why was it important for you to tell the stories of the characters surrounding the two main characters as well?
Yeah, I think what I loved about them most is that they were ordinary. It could be your neighbour. And that relatability meant that I felt that audiences would be able to genuinely connect with these characters. Also, they're full, and a lot of the discussions that they have are not in relation to men. They're funny, they're bold, and it's their community. They take full ownership of it. She's really put them and really celebrated what they can offer.
The reaction from the audience is immense as well.
Yeah.
I don't think I've heard anything like it. The booing and the jeering and the intakes of breath, because the language is raw and cutting.
Completely.
But then, language doing what it's meant to do.
Completely.
Lenny, can you tell us a bit more about these miscegenation laws, though, in the United States? And tell us about the most famous case in 1967 that actually ended the anti-miscegenation laws.
Well, there had always been, a discouragement of these kinds of relationships. In the North, they weren't necessarily the law, but they certainly were the ordinary social expectation that these things were very discouraged. The Lovings, by 67, had been living as a couple, considered that they had married, I believe, in Washington, D.C., which had different laws, and they came back to Virginia and were living where it was illegal and were finally brought to court over it, and luckily had the kind of, I believe, the NAACP and other advocates who helped the process reach the Supreme Court. And luckily, of course, at that time, our Supreme Court had a much more liberal view of the private rights of people. Mm. And that's basically how they found was that it is unconstitutional to limit who or what an individual may do in their private marital choices. And it certainly helped in the remaining southern states where it had been struck down. But it also freed up many, many interracial marriages of all kinds, white women and black men and black men and black women and white men.
All ethnicities. And it's
to come out and be themselves
absolutely.
And be much
and June friend. June the 12th, the date of the Supreme Court decision, I like this detail a lot, is still remembered as Loving Day. What an appropriate surname the two of them had. It couldn't mm-hmm. be poetic.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yes, it is a very important date.
That's Dr. Leni Sorensen and Monique Tuchot. And Wedding Band, A Love-Hate Story in Black and White, is on at the Lyric Hammersmith in London until June the 29th. Finally, do you remember your first love? Is that feeling unforgettable or maybe regrettable? Was the love reciprocated? Did you fall for your best friend by chance? How did that work out? Or maybe your best friend fell for you. Earlier this week, Nuala was joined by the author Laura Dockrill, who has written her first novel for adults. She's previously written young adult and children's books. Her memoir, What Have I Done, dealt with her postpartum psychosis. But the new book goes back to girlhood. I Love You, I Love You, I Love You is about a girl, Ella, who loves a boy, Lo. Here's Laura reading the bit where Ella sees Lo for the very first time.
And that's when the world around me drowns out and all I hear are the rising power chords of Lenny Kravitz's Fly Away and the boy better run for his life. I am on. With just a look, I fall through the ground where I split, come undone like a seed and burst from my shell. His eyes trigger a network of roots and shoots that tangle and connect with a force strong enough to light up a city with full power. Ping, ping, ping. My walls, with a wrecking ball of a look from him, pound down to a grit, and I am lost in the thunderous dust, inhaling only this new person, this starburst galaxy, this riptide, this hurricane, and yet as sweet and as delicious as crisp cherryade. He is so fit. Everybody around me is talking, but I'm in my head because, see, he is there now, waiting, chill as hell, like he was there all along with an icebox of snacks and beer, camping out in the canyons of my mind.
And opposite me is Laura Dockrill, listening to yourself. That was Ella falling for Lo, and this is fiction. But was it like that for you when you first met your husband? And I will give full disclosure for our listeners, your partner is Hugo White, formerly of the indie rock band The Maccabees.
Yes, embarrassingly, yes. I think, you know, this is partly why I wanted to write the book, was that I thought love really wasn't for me. I was so, as a teenager, I was always friend zoning myself, could never find the boy zone. And I guess with crushing insecurity and all those things, you know, just didn't think that would be on my radar. And then annoyed when I met this really lovely
what
guy.
What age were you?
I was 14 in Wandsworth, South London. We made mixtapes for each other, love letters, mixtapes and letters that I would spray with White Mask Body Shop. Don't worry about it. No expense spared. In the hope that would entrance him.
Did it work?
I would set him up with my friends. I would do all those things. It's just basically self-sabotage. Cut to age 19. I am standing in a shower, wearing a bikini for the first time in my life. Drunk, unfortunately. I tell him that I love him and he says nothing back. And we do not see each other for 10 years. 10 years. And now we're married with a baby. What?
What?
I know. I know, now we're married. Yeah, so when we actually did hook up at age 30 and see each other after all this time, you know, he'd been on tour and had success with his band and everything, and I just felt like my life had stood still, you know, I'd in the same house doing the same job. Why would he find me and my miniature life interesting? But he'd kept everything, every little ring pull from a Coke can and letter. And I had nothing to show him. So I thought I'd better write a book about this.
So why didn't it happen back then? You obviously, you know, held a candle for him or a flame for him, however you want to describe it.
Oh, there was a candle. Oh, yeah.
Or maybe it was a Roman
a bonfire.
Candle. Exactly. For him. But he didn't reciprocate at that point when you were in the shower drunk in the bikini.
No.
Which you would think that might have been a moment.
That might have been the moment. For anybody that knows Hugo, you know, he really is the most kindest, gentlest person. And I genuinely think he was shocked. You know, we'd been very close for a good 5 years at this point. And I think he was like, you hid that well, sort of thing. Maybe didn't take me seriously. Certainly didn't want to take advantage or anything like that. And so he said nothing. I just remember him saying nothing.
But then, you know, there were very famous bands touring. You'd hear their music, no doubt, as you went about life. And
so, yeah, there was a billboard in my house where he, you know, we weren't speaking, and it would be his music would be in the cool down to my like workout classes, or I'd be at a friend's party and his song would come on. And, you know, that is such a nuanced thing where they're everywhere. And with fame, you know, I've had a few friends that have done well in acting or music or whatever, various things. And that feeling of them being everywhere and everyone feeling connected to them, like they know them, and they're nowhere to be seen in your life. And you have this intimacy with them that you know what they're truly like. But they, you know, you're not in their address book, you're not in their phone book. And that feeling is something I wanted to try and put into
words. You did. I mean, reading it, oh God, the love-struck teenager, how painful.
It's so painful.
It's almost like an illness for your character, Ella.
Yes, it is like an illness. You know, having written a lot for children's books, you know, I when I visit schools, and the feelings they feel at that time is so huge, you know. And I never want to be that person when, you know, when a kid, you know, my little boy, 6 and a half, someone just told him yesterday they loved him. There's an instruction that they're getting married tomorrow and he has to dress handsome. It's like for me to just demolish that and say that's not real or it won't last. You know, actually, these relationships, they're what shape us. They're what teach us how to love, how to feel empathy and kindness. And really, it is a friendship book. And it doesn't go away. You know, the response from the book has almost been as strong as the postpartum psychosis book, in the sense that people, as you've just been, you know, gorgeous hearing these stories, have been going, I felt that as well, I had that. Although, you know, be careful when you're reaching out to the people from your past, you know.
Was that difficult for you, in the sense, obviously you had to get Hugo on board, I imagine.
Oh, yeah.
And you're obviously incredibly honest and frank, and we can talk about postpartum psychosis, the memoir you had on that as well, What Have I Done? But you're kind of putting yourself out there, or how much of you is in it? I mean, I'm thinking it's you when I'm reading Ella. I don't know whether I'm right about that.
Yeah, a lot of me is in there. And I think that is the journey of a writer, is that is our job. We communicate our lived experience. We're the ones that eat the poisonous berries to tell you what the path ahead is like, you know, in return, and say, yeah, I got sick, don't eat those berries.
Mm-hmm. Love sick, boy.
But she's there. But I was really hard on myself as a teenager, which has been surprising. So many of my friends felt the same way. Oh, I'm not good enough. I can't do this. And it comes up a lot in my children's work and work for young adults. And I suppose I wanted to come full circle, really, being in the guilt and shame, the heartache of writing about the postpartum psychosis was such a harsh, brutal place to live in and write in for so many years. And I do see these books as sisters. This is sort of the light, you know, there's light and shade with the two. I don't write about the psychosis in the book, but, you know, Hugo is a real reminder that life, for all of its injustices, can be a really good place. You know, we've been through a lot together as teenagers as well, and he's taught me a lot about compassion and kindness. And our friendship is really what was the medicine that fixed me when I was sick too.
And, you know, we have touched on their postpartum psychosis. You know, I read some of what you went through. Absolutely shocking. It's something you shared widely. You've written a book about it to try and help others, I suppose, that have that might be eating the poison berries, to use some of your words. How are you doing now? I mean, you look amazing. Oh, you look like a vision of joy.
Yeah, I'm well. Thank you for asking. So it's 6.5 years on since being ill, and writing this book really does feel like a, you know, it's nice. It's so nice to be in a sweet spot now where we're talking about lovely things, because I was in the hard stuff for a while.
Do you mind giving people just a brief?
Sure. So in 2018, after my little boy Jet was born, and following on from a traumatic labour, I was hit with a debilitating mental illness known as postpartum psychosis. I'd never experienced any mental illness before, so I couldn't qualify it, couldn't quantify it. And 3 weeks, when my little boy was just 3 weeks, I woke up on my first Mother's Day in a psychiatric ward, separated from him, and spent, well, I had to begin my life again. So spent the next 2 weeks doing group therapy in a general psych ward and rebuilding from there. But, you know, I'm so grateful. You know, I've learned so much from that experience. I feel so much more plugged in to life. And in my 30s, I think that's a really cool thing to learn. I can teach my son about mental illness, teach him to ask for help if he needs it. This would never have been things that were in my language.
You went into a different world.
I went into a different world. Yes, I did. And the shame was still probably the worst symptom of all. You know, it's like, oh, does that mean I'm a bad mum? Does that mean I don't care? Am I not kind? Am I unable to love? Am I broken? How am I going to come back from this? How am I going to write books? And I can't even go to Tesco's again, let alone hold my little boy. But as I said, you know, trusting Hugo and the people around me that have been there. And the book, it really is about Hugo, but it's a fiction as well. It's about the friends that have, I'm still best mates with my friends since I was three, my friends since school. That sense of identity that I'd spent all of that time building, it wasn't for waste. So basically, fill those diaries, because you're in there, you know, that is your inner self, those teenage diaries.
And in what many of our listeners might consider an unusual twist in this story, not just that your husband is from the Maccabees, but the friend who spoke to Hugo saying, you know, maybe something is up, but Laura isn't well, was Adele. Yes, that Adele.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that again was a, All those, as I said, the nuance, like all those years of just, you know, talking rubbish on the sofa, it does count for something, because when you're sick, someone can know in a flicker of your eye that, okay, this person is unwell. It's our bond, I think, our sister bond is what got us there. So, it's so important to ask for help and say how you're feeling in the best ways you can.
Laura Dockerill talking to Nuala, and her latest book, I Love You, I Love You, I Love You, is out now. And that is it from Weekend Woman's Hour. Thank you so much for your company. On Monday, Nuala will be joined by Helen Hecate, who'll be discussing her new novel, which is about dealing with life-changing events. But for now, from me, have a lovely weekend.